Okay, so perturbation methods. So we've done the proof, and the results are, you know, essentially tattooable. They're short and sweet and important. But kind of to give some context, the idea is that we have a problem, a Hamiltonian, which we can break apart into a piece that we can solve and a piece that we can't solve, or at least can't solve exactly. And whether there is an adjustable constant or whether we just insert one is kind of up to us. For the Zeeman effect, for the Stark effect, there is an electric or a magnetic field that we could have be anything between zero and some maximum value. If the perturbation doesn't have such a real adjustable parameter, we can still imagine, you know, changing the charge on an electron or something in a continuous way. So the idea is that the actual energies of one of these wave functions would depend on lambda in some complicated functional way, which we can calculate by a Taylor series expansion. So here's our Taylor's series expansion for the exact energy. Here's our Taylor series expansion for the exact wave function. You should notice that there's lots of compact notation going on here. One piece of the compact notation is where everything we are doing is telling us how the nth state is changing in energy, and that's not encoded much any place in these notations. So Griffiths would put, you know, little things like that on top of basically everything to tell you that this is how the nth state is changing. But I'm just warning you about that. So if we plug and chug this through and we make this Wolog without loss of generality statement, that we're assuming that there's none of the original wave function in the perturbed wave functions. And that is a Wolog because it's basically just a choice of normalization. And the original equation doesn't care if psi is normalized or not. Any multiple of psi would work just as well. So kind of in real life, if we used a normalized psi, we would start out with psi being 100% the unperturbed solution. And as we built up pieces of non-n phis, the value for phi n would have to go down, right? Because it would have to be normalized. You buying that? So if we think about phi as being a combination of the exact wave function being a combination of these easy solution problems, these phis, for lambda equals zero, psi is phi. And as we build up various values of lambda, we're going to get more terms in our equation. And if we have more terms in the rest of it, that means we have to have less in phi n. So that would be the case if we had a normalized solution. But instead, it makes the algebra a whole lot easier to assume that we always normalize our wave function so that the coefficient in front of phi n is exactly 1. And since there was 1 in the original double-barred psi, there won't be any in the perturbed values. I don't know, is anyone unhappy with that? So in the real normalized version of psi, there would be a term that would be dependent upon lambda for the phi n term. And basically what we're dealing with is the function we're calculating is that coefficient divided through the normalized version of psi, which is therefore guaranteed to have exactly a 1 in the phi n position. Okay. And it does make things hugely easier to solve, to have that conclusion. And here is the upshot. The first order perturbed energy is just the expectation value of the perturbing potential. And the second order perturbation has these energy denominators, where we have energy difference between states that are connected to the original state. So this word connected simply means that from the original state, this integral is non-zero. Okay, so, oh, and here's the perturbed wave function, which is considerably less of interest. Usually we just care about the energies, but we derived that, so I've listed that too. Questions?
How does
that
equal zero again?
How does this equal zero? So,
isn't there a phi in the psi? Like phi n?
So this is the ith one, right?
Okay.
So what I'm claiming is that there's no phi n in this, and this. So that all of the phi n is just in the original version of it. Questions? Well, what could go wrong with perturbation theory? Well, the big problem we're going to talk about today has to do with degeneracy. So if we're thinking about the Stark effect, with the Zeeman effect, which we dealt with before, we had 2s and 2p levels, which is a total of 4 levels, and we were concerned about how these energies were going to change when we applied a magnetic field. And if we looked at a particular state, you know, say the 2p m equals 0 state, it may well connect to the 2p m equals 1 state, and then we would have a 0 in the denominator. And zeros in the denominator are infinities, and that's not good. Can't afford to have that. What was the problem that was really on the mind of physicists in the 1950s after after World War II, when people had time to think about real physics, were a couple of other problems which we're not going to address. Infrared divergences and ultraviolet divergences. We're not going to see these problems because we're mostly dealing with discrete set of states. But if you think about continuous motion, particles that are scattering off particles, there are always states that are just a little bit more energetic than what you've got. You know, just give it an extra hundredth of a meter of a second, and you're going to have a state that has very much the same energy, but is a different state. So if we have low energy systems, we can get things that are nearly zero in the denominator, and if we add them all up, we can get an infrared divergence. And it turns out the same thing can happen at the far end. Far end doesn't look as bad because we're going to be getting big numbers in the denominator, big energy differences, but there are huge numbers of states. There are lots more states that have more energy than have less energy. And turns out that the extra number of states can overwhelm the bigger number that's in the denominator, and you can have infinities produced by those sorts of problems. So we mostly see this is seen in terms of continuous states, scattering problems. We're mostly dealing with bound states, so we're not going to see this much. So the solution to this is called renormalization. And it's a it's a tricky, tricky long-term story. So luckily we have an easier story, degeneracy. And it has a fairly easy solution. So first of all, let's kind of get a feeling for why there is this problem. And the best analogy I can think of is if we think about the motion of something on a perfectly flat surface. It doesn't matter what we choose for our x and y axis because everything is exactly the same. But if I turn on a potato chip sort of shape function on this flat surface, suddenly there becomes one direction that is special and another direction that is special. And so our original coordinate system is probably not going to be in line with the special coordinate system. So in order to do the perturbation, even if this is arbitrarily small, we're going to have to make a big shift in our basis functions. So there are a couple of things that are good with this analogy. First of all, if you happen to pick the right direction in this case to begin with, there's no problem, right? When you turn on the perturbation, there wouldn't be any big shifts, right? So big shifts, of course, correspond to big derivatives. In fact, infinite derivatives, which come about by having these energy differences that are zero. Okay, so when we have degeneracy, it's really a matter of choosing the right basis for those degenerate states. And the definition of right is that we don't get any infinities here. And the only way we can avoid infinities is if these terms are zero at the same time that these terms are zero. So we'll be doing good if the perturbation doesn't connect any of the degenerate states. Right, so what that means is that if phi I and phi j are two of these degenerate states, that term is always zero. So when this is zero, that'll be zero. And even though zero over zero doesn't seem real comfortable, it's a lot better than something over infinity. Okay, so the solution to degeneracy, when I read it in textbooks, always seems harder than it really is. So if you have a degenerate case, the solution, all you need to do is the following. Calculate all of these sorts of matrices in the collection of degenerate states. Okay, so if we're thinking about this sort of problem, all we need to do is to calculate all of these various integrals, right? Integrals where we have p1 and our potential and p0, p-1, etc. Calculate all of those integrals. So in the particular case I'm thinking about, if I ignore this S state at least, that's going to be a 3x3 matrix. And find the eigenvectors and values. Of that matrix. And use those as your new basis for the degenerate set of functions. It'll be handy, I guess, to have a name of this. I'll call this the degenerate subspace. Right, we have a vector space of all of the linear combinations of all of the functions. If we just have a linear combination of the degenerate functions, I'll call that the degenerate subspace. And that'll do, usually, not always, but usually it'll do all that's required in order to solve the problem. The eigenvalues, they'll be the values of the first order perturbed energy. And automatically, these things will be zero, so we won't have any infinities in our program. Okay, so I don't know, maybe it's worth demonstrating that. So here's my matrix of these, and let me assume I have a vector A, and I get, it's an eigenvalue, so I get some energy A out of it. And I have exactly the same thing for a different energy EB. So first of all, we are guaranteed that as column vectors, these guys are orthogonal. Remember, we proved that the if we have different values for our eigenvectors that have different eigenvalues are guaranteed to be orthogonal. So automatically, it has to be the case that B dagger A is equal to zero. Okay, so let's make a new function, phi A, which is a linear combination given by these coefficients, and a wave function B that is given as a linear combination of those coefficients. And I claim that if we do the integral of phi B phi A, we're in fact going to get exactly zero. Okay, so this is pretty easy calculation to make. So what we're going to get then, if we just plug in this for phi A and that for phi B, we're going to have a double sum. And maybe it'll be helpful if I use different labels, right? Whatever I label those, it doesn't really matter because they're just going through the full set. So I'm going to have a sum over the J and the I of B complex conjugated, because it's a bra as opposed to a ket. And then I'm going to have phi J V phi I AI. And this combination, if you look at it, that's just exactly matrix multiplication. So this quantity here is exactly equal to what it says. It's equal to EA times AJ. And then we know that when we dot these, the EA is a constant. It comes outside of the sum. And we know that when we dot these two guys together, we're going to get zero. Okay. So I don't know, that seems simple, at least theoretically it's simple. This process of finding the eigenvectors and values, the textbook usually shows you that in ugly detail, and you know that in terms of the algebra of finding eigenvectors and values, it's kind of ugly. But in a theoretical sense, and in a mathematica sense, it's easy to find eigenvectors and values. And so if we put a curtain over that process, I hope it all seems pretty straightforward. Okay, so let's take a look at an example. So one problem with all of these sorts of problems that we're going to be dealing with approximation methods, is the problems tend to get pretty long. And so we have to have a pretty simple problem in order to make something realistic. in order to give us what we need. So first of all, to have degenerate states, we never had degenerate states when we were just working in one dimension. So we got to have multiple dimensions. And the fewest multiple dimensions you can have is two. So let's have a two-dimensional problem. And the simplest problems are infinite square well problems. So let this be an infinite square well with side L. And we know that the eigenfunctions can be written as nx, ny. This is one of the wave functions, is going to be 2 over L, that's the normalization factor, and then sine of nx pi x divided by L and sine of ny pi y divided by L. And the corresponding energy, which of course depends on nx and ny, is h bar squared pi squared divided by 2m L squared, nx squared plus ny squared. I don't know. We've seen this before. The signs are required, and those particular things are required so that we fit full half wavelengths inside the box, both in terms of x and y. Okay, so about the simplest set of degenerate states we can have is 1 and 2, and 2 and 1. Right? So this guy here has a node in the y direction, and this guy here has a node in the x direction. And they're degenerate states one step above the ground state, which is, of course, 1, 1. Okay, so we've got a degeneracy and we've got an exact problem. That's all that we needed in order to get this set up. So now we need a perturbation. So what's the simplest perturbation? Well, delta functions, right? Because we can do integrals with delta functions without a whole lot of work. So let's make our perturbation have some adjustable constant and a delta function. And we don't want to choose things to be too symmetric. So I'm going to choose to have this delta function have its point at 1/3 and 1/4. I have to see which one I chose which way. So I'm choosing it to have x be at 1/3. And y at 1/4. Right, so right about here, there's a delta function, and we're interested in how these states are how these states' energy is going to depend on their corresponding values. Okay, so all we have to do is do lots of integrals. So what we need to do is, I don't know if it'll help to call these A and B or not, but maybe I will. So let me call this A and this B. So what we need to do is A VA and A VB and B VB. If you think about it, this one here has to be the complex conjugate of that one there. And in fact, since everything's real, the complex conjugate is just going to be the same as that one there. Okay, so off to the races. So this guy here is going to be, we got two of these wave functions, so we're going to end up with this thing squared. Our potential has a lambda in it, and then we're going to have the double integral over x and y of the two corresponding wave functions. So we're going to have a sine of pi x divided by L squared, sine of 2 pi y divided by L squared. And then we have our delta functions. And the whole point of this was that it was going to be easy to evaluate those delta functions. The integral, all we have to do is put in x equals L over 3, and we'll be good. So I put in x is L over 3. I get the sine of pi over 3. And the sine of pi over 3 is? So this is 60 degrees, so this is the square root of 3 over 2. And I need to plug in for my y integral that L, that y is equal to L over 4. So this is going to give me the sine of pi over 2. And the sine of pi over 2 is? The sine of pi over 2 is? 90 degrees is pi over 2. Yeah, save that answer. Okay, so this guy here, so we've got this big ugly constant out front, which mostly I think I'm not going to worry about. So what we've got for this guy here is that big ugly constant, and then this thing squared, right? So we've got three quarters. Okay, how about this one here? Well, we have, again, that big ugly constant, and then we've got double integral. Now x is the one that has the 2 in it, so this is going to be sine of 2 pi x divided by L squared sine of pi y L squared. And then we have our delta functions. And it's pretty easy to do those integrals. All we have to do is plug in that x is L over 3, and now we get the sine of 2 pi over 3. What's the sine of 2 pi over 3? Same as the sine of pi over 3. It's the square root of 3 over 2. And here we get the sine of pi over 4 squared. And sine of pi over 4 is?
That's square root of 2 over 2.
1 over the square root of 2. So what this guy here is then, is it's that big ugly box. And we've got the 3 quarters from that and the 1 half from the sine term. Okay, well, one last term to calculate. This one takes more time to write out. We've got that ugly constant, and now we've got both of them. So we've got sine of 2 pi x divided by L and sine of pi x divided by L, right? One from each term, and we've got sine of 2 pi y divided by L and sine of pi y divided by L. Integrals, and of course the delta functions. Because they're delta functions, they're easy to integrate. We just put in x is equal to L over 3, and here we get 2 pi over 3, and here we get pi over 3. But both of them were the square root of 3 over 2, so I'm going to get 3 quarters from that. When I plug in y is equal to L over 4, I get pi over 2, and this one is 1, and this one is 1 over the square root of 2. So this integral here is that box times 3 quarters times 1 over the square root of 2. Okay, so although the process is easy to describe, it does take a fair amount of algebra in order to do it. So what we've got then for our matrix V is this box, right, which is 2 over L squared lambda. Everything also has a 3 quarters in it, so let me pull that out too. And so I've got 1 over the square root of 2, 1 over the square root of 2, and 1 half. So now I need to find the eigenvalues of that matrix. And of course, that overall constant is just going along for the ride. So all I really need to do is to find the eigenvalues of the matrix as it sits there. Okay, well, 1 minus x, 1 over the square root of 2, 1 over the square root of 2, 1 half minus x. So what I get is 1 minus x, 1 half minus x, and then I get minus a half from that piece of the determinant. Notice that that term is going to exactly cancel the previous term. So what I've got is, well, I've got this piece here, which is x squared, and I've got this piece here and that piece there, which is going to be minus 3 halves x. So that factors. So one eigenvalue is 0, and the other eigenvalue is 3 halves. It's pretty easy to see the eigenvector that corresponds to x equals 0, right? 1 comma minus the square root of 2. If I do that matrix multiplication on top, I get 0. And if I do that matrix multiplication below, I also get 0. We could work out, and maybe we will work out, the 3 halves, but there's a trick, right? The eigenvectors have to be orthogonal. And if I've picked one direction, then the other one has to be the square root of 2, 1, right? It has to be orthogonal. When I dot it with the other one, I have to get 0. I don't know. We can check that out, I guess. Let's check it out for the bottom piece of it. So if I do this integral, what I'm going to get is 1 plus a half, which is exactly 3 halves times what I have for this entry. Okay, so that means that the good wave functions that are already directed kind of in the right way, are a wave function that is, well, what should I call it? Let me call it alpha. It's equal, well, this thing isn't normalized, right? So I'm going to punt on the normalization. It's going to have some normalization, and then it's going to be 1, 2 minus the square root of 2 of 2, 1. And the corresponding first order energy shift is 0. And if you were to plot out this function, here's our delta function. So it turns out, I don't know, it looks kind of like that. It has a node right where the perturbation is. So it's unperturbed. And that also means that it never connects to anything through the perturbation. Right? So you choose your favorite function, plug in anything you want there, and it's got to be 0, because you're going to, in the end, have the integrand evaluated at the delta function point, and this wave function cleverly has arranged to have a 0 there. And of course, the other wave function, some normalization, square root of 2, 1, 2, plus 2, 1. And if you go and plot it out, you'll find that that wave function nearly has a maximum. It can't arrange to have a maximum, but its maximum is pretty close to where the delta function is. So it's maximally perturbed. And the corresponding first order perturbed energy would be that 3 halves. Now, I haven't bothered to do it, but we could probably go on and calculate the second order energy shift if we really wanted to. Right? Because Mathematica knows in the denominator we would have these n squared minus k squared sorts of terms, and Mathematica actually knows how to sum those things. So I haven't tried it. Maybe it's wrong, but it wouldn't surprise me if you could actually exactly calculate the second order shift for this problem also. But in any case, it's not infinity because nothing connects these states. Okay, so in principle, easy. With Mathematica, not too bad. On the blackboard, we actually have to do these integrals. It's not all that much fun. We didn't do any of this for the Zeeman effect. And that's a degenerate set of states. So did we lie? So we just calculated the expectation value of SZ and assumed that that was the first order energy shift, as if there was no perturbation. Well, it's safe as long as the magnetic field doesn't connect any two of these states that are degenerate. So is that the case? Right? So we had states that had some J and M. And if they had different values of M, they had the same energy, they were degenerate. Do we have to worry about this guy? Okay, so if M connects to any other one, we're in trouble, right? If it connects to itself, we're okay. That's the first order energy shift. But if it connects to something else in the degenerate class, we're in trouble. Well, we're guaranteed that these are all zero. And let's see why. So remember that SZ commutes with the total angular momentum vector. And it does that, of course, because SZ certainly commutes with itself, and SZ certainly commutes with LZ because they're totally different coordinates. And if we think about this integral, what is it going to turn out to be? Well, so when we have the direct order, this is going to be J, M prime, expectation value of S, and JZ is just going to bring out an M. When we have them in the other order, the JZ can operate on the Brough state, and we're going to get M prime. So what we've got then is 0 equals m minus m prime times this matrix element that we're concerned about. M minus m prime isn't 0, so that matrix element better be 0. In the case where we're worried about the expectation value where m is equal to m prime, well, we calculate it. That term in general wasn't 0, which is perfectly fine. So this is a common trick. If we can find an operator that commutes with the perturbation, then we can find a set of states that are automatically not connected, maybe without going through this diagonalization problem, the problem of finding the eigenvectors of a general sort of matrix. Okay, so Zeeman was a degenerate perturbation problem, but it's a degenerate perturbation problem in which our first choice of wave functions was the right choice, was a choice in which there was no connection through the perturbation between states that are in the same degenerate class. That's not going to be the case with the Stark effect, right? So with the Stark effect, we add an electric field, and an electric field has a potential that you remember, if we have it in the z direction, is minus a constant E naught times z. So we're then going to be very concerned with the expectation values of z. And think about it, all of those are going to be zero. All of these wave functions are as much going up as they are going down. So theoretically, the Stark order shift, first order shifts are zero, but they're not. There are states that are connected. Different values of, where we have a different function here and here that connect through the perturbation. And so if we naively continued, we'd get infinity for the second order term. So for Stark, we do need to do this process of diagonalizing the matrix of the perturbation over the degenerate subspace. Questions? Well, what kind of comes next in the chapter? Well, historically, I mean, in some sense, atomic physics has been done and nuclear physics has been done, so particle physics is perhaps more interesting, but historically, when people were working out quantum mechanics, their concern was the hydrogen atom. And what you've got in front of you is the real story. So in Bohr's approximation, we had that all of the principal quantum number three states, that is to say, you know, 3s, 3p, 3d, all of those had exactly the same energy. But if you look up here, we've got all of those three states, and they don't have the same energy. And so the plan is to work our way through and see what these states really are. So of course, there were lots of things that Bohr left out. So the two most obvious ones are relativity. The electrons in the hydrogen atom are moving about 1% of the speed of light. So relativity is small but measurable, even in Bohr's time, shifts. And no one knew that the electron had spin. I'm trying to remember when we celebrated the centennial of the discovery of the electron, but surprisingly late, something like 1900. So certainly in Bohr's time, people didn't know that the electron had spin. And then we have all of these other tricky complications, like the fact that the gyromagnetic ratio of the electron is twice as big as we expect classically. And there's another tricky aspect called Thomas precession that turns out to reduce the gyromagnetic ratio of electrons in some circumstances back to its classical level. So lots of tricky things going on. So how far are we going to get in this, and kind of what's the story? So if you look at those N equals three levels, you can, if you kind of squint and don't pay careful attention to the ordering, it looks kind of like these guys have the same energies and these guys have the same energies and this guy has a higher energy. And that calculation is one we'll make in class. And that's a combination of relativity and spin. So relativity and spin by themselves give that that nice result. This splitting, that's called the fine structure. And there's a dimensionless parameter called alpha, the fine structure constant, which is approximately equal to 1 over 137. That kind of determines the relative size of that splitting. Okay, and actually all of this was known in Bohr's day. That is to say, the measurements were there to show the fine structure splitting, which Bohr's theory did not reproduce. Oddly enough, when people took Bohr's theory and added relativity, it worked perfectly, even though they didn't know that there was spin. So basically, the mistake of using Bohr's theory as opposed to proper theory and ignoring spin canceled and gave the right answer. This was discouraging to Schrödinger because at the time when Schrödinger was working, 1925, Bohr's theory was better than his. Bohr's theory predicted fine structure and his didn't. So historically, what Schrödinger, why bother with non-relativistic results? Schrödinger started to find the relativistic quantum mechanics of an electron, and it gave the wrong answer, so he just substituted the non-relativistic version of it. And then it took Dirac to figure out what was going on, which involves spin. So this, in fact, small shift, the Lamb shift, that's a post-World War II discovery, and that set physicists busy to work because it was not predicted by the then available best possible theory, which was Dirac's theory, Dirac's relativistic quantum mechanics. So explaining the Lamb shift was very much on the mind of people in the 1950s, and in order to do it, they had to conquer those problems that we mentioned before. The infrared divergence and the ultraviolet divergence. And the process of doing that is renormalization. And the first guy who pretty much did it was Bethe. But Bethe only did it non-relativistically and kind of with a little bit of hand waving. So then it was up to people like Schwinger and Feynman in order to get things right finally with only a moderate amount of hand waving. And now we're up to people who I've actually met. Living people who are now dead. Now, all of these people are now dead, but at least we're living when I was a graduate student. So the final thing is, if you look at all of these levels, they're also split by what's called the hyperfine splitting. So not only does the electron have spin, but the proton has spin. So the spinning proton is going to have a magnetic dipole moment, which is going to interact with the electron's dipole moment, and there's going to be a shift based on that. And this was also very famous result because it's important for astronomy. So most of the universe is hydrogen. Most of the hydrogen in the universe is in its ground state. And the only available transition is this transition between the triplet and the singlet state, whether the proton and the electron are aligned or whether they're anti-aligned. And so radio telescopes, to this day, commonly measure what they see of hydrogen in the 21 centimeter line, that's the wavelength, or this 1420 megahertz frequency. It is incidentally a highly forbidden transition, right? Because we've said for transitions, the L had to change and all of these other things. And obviously these are all in the ground state, so the L isn't changing. But so-called forbidden things happen. And there's a lot of the universe and there's a lot of hydrogen out there. So even though the half-life of the excited state is measured in millions of years, there's enough transition to be visible. Okay, so that's the plan for next time and for the rest of the chapter, to figure out how relativity and spin combine to give you degeneracies. Sometimes it's called the lambda degeneracy between those pair of states and a separation that's called the fine structure. And of course, we'll do that with the perturbation theory that we've just invented. And mostly, we'll be able to do it with, even though it's a degenerate problem, just as with the Zeeman states, we really didn't have to worry too much about the degeneracy. Same thing will apply here. Okay, so I think that's going to be it for today.